You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Morena, you are on 95BFM, and we are going to listen now to a chat that I had with Stella Donnelly, who performed at Laneway on Monday. She's from Australia, from Fremantle, to be precise, and she was really lovely. Her album, Beware of the Dogs, came out last year, and I know a lot of people up at the station really, really enjoyed it, so it was a huge pleasure to be able to chat to her about that record and about her Laneway performance as well. We're going to listen to some live tracks as well that were recorded on that day. We're going to kick it off with Lunch. She played the Rangers stage, and this is from that set.
This song's called Lunch.
Cracking my neck in the consulate line while a homesick American flag's hanging by in the flue. Up close I see how they stitched on the stars and stripes. If I were honest and if you were brave, you'd ask me your question and stay for the answer. I like the way that you tell all your tales. Would it kill you to listen?
Stella Donnelly.
How you going?
I'm good. I'm hot. It's very warm outside.
It's very warm.
I'm so excited to talk to you because Beware of the Dogs has been honestly one of my favourite albums from last year, and I know it's been a lot of people at BFM, which is our radio station's favourite record of the year too. I think one thing that I loved about this album and that I know lots of friends of mine loved about this album is that you tackle these huge issues that women especially deal with every day, but you do it with such humour, as well as, you know, you get the knife in when you need to. Does it get a little bit exhausting for you kind of rehashing that every time you perform it, or does it feel kind of like catharsis maybe?
I feel like performing in general is pretty exhausting at times, and I used to play in a cover band back in the day where we would just play other people's songs every night for corporate functions and stuff like that, and I found that far more exhausting because I wasn't actually kind of telling the truth, you know. It's like that feeling of like, all right, from now on if I'm going to be on stage, I'm actually going to be saying something that I feel resonates with me,
yeah,
and I feel like I need to. So in a way it almost kind of makes it less exhausting because sometimes you don't know why you're on the stage performing, especially when there's things going on in the world and stuff like that. So getting to speak about it makes you feel less insignificant,
yeah,
and less kind of ridiculous.
Well, I think that's why people love listening to it as well, is we still don't hear a lot of stories like this necessarily sung so frankly.
Oh, thank you for feeling that way.
Thanks
I'm very
for writing
relieved
it.
That people listen to it, because I'd just be talking to myself otherwise.
I feel like that's the beautiful thing about music, is you'll always find somebody else be like, yes, that is exactly the feeling.
Yeah, totally.
I've seen you talk a little bit about this in other interviews, about how when you are a young woman writing stories that have this kind of personal political element to them, people do often just immediately slap the autobiographical label,
yes,
on it, and you know, the guys don't have to worry about that. Is that something that frustrates you a little bit?
Only when it stops people from, you know, reaching their full kind of potential or something like that. I find that, you know, it's okay if I'm getting slapped with that label, but you know, as long as it doesn't start kind of inhibiting my opportunities and stuff like, you know, stuff like that, because
yeah,
not all of my songs are autobiographical, you know, a lot of them are based and inspired by things that have happened in my life, but you know, I also flourish and do those, you know, those little extra bits around it, and you know, think of ideas and stuff like that. So you know, it can be frustrating, but I try not to let it stop me. Yeah,
and I think that's what people I mean, young women perhaps listening to your record find as well, as it is also amazing to hear someone be like, hey, this maybe it happened to me, maybe it didn't happen to me, maybe it happened to a friend, but it's a true thing that, you know, goes on.
Totally.
And we need to have these conversations, frankly.
Totally. And, you know, I write songs to be accessible, and in a way I would rather people think that it's autobiographical and can connect to the song rather than for them to be like, what is this kind of weird thing happening?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I would take the bad with the good in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She blames herself.
Dogs, the name of your record and also the name of one of the tracks on your album, is kind of looking a little bit at the Australian government.
Yeah.
And we are, what, a day after Invasion Day now?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
How does that feel over in Australia, like on Invasion Day, Australia Day, depending what side of the fence you're on?
Yeah, totally. Well, for me, I speak about this stuff as a as a white Australian, which, you know, makes me a colonizer, really. So I say all of this coming from a very privileged standpoint. But, you know, our the abhorrent treatment of our First Nations people in Australia, I don't want to say our, sorry, of the First Nations people in Australia, hasn't stopped. And it's just, you know, the fact that we're still celebrating on a day that on the 26th of January is actually a day of grief for a lot of First Nations Australians, not all of them, but a lot of them. And I think, you know, there's kind of nationwide protests happening about it, but nothing's changing, and a lot of things need to change, you know. It's not just this day. There's just like a whole institutionalized, conditioned racism that exists in Australia, so-called Australia. So yeah, it's a pretty awful thing that, you know, we've still got a bunch of white Australians, you know, throwing barbecues and you know, getting really pissed and doing bucket bongs on a day that's meant to be kind of a day of silence. Yeah.
How do you feel, as you're saying, as a white Australian performing music that touches on these massive topics as well? Do you think it's like a kind of a duty, maybe, to be talking about that?
Yeah, it's a really fine thing, and I take it really seriously. You know, it's something that I feel as though if I've been given this platform, which could be taken by any Australian, anyone, I should use that a little bit to spread some messages. And you know, there might be a point where I feel as though I should just step down and give someone else that platform. But until then, I feel as though I should just use what I have right now to kind of be an ally, I guess. Yeah. But I don't want any rewards for that either. You know, I feel like there are so many bigger struggles happening for other people and other artists, other, you know, women of colour in Australia, and, you know, First Nations artists in Australia deserve more of a platform than many of us have got, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very kind of delicate matter.
Doesn't know its face is
You've worked with some brilliant people, and I'm happy to see that you're also on the same billing as your friend Julia Jacklin.
Yes, yeah.
You guys did a video together for Trix. How did that come about?
Well, her best friend, like from many years, Nick McKinley, is an amazing videographer, and he's very well sought after by many artists. And we reached out to him to do the Trix video, and then he kind of emailed us back saying, oh, my friend Julia, who I knew instantly who that was because he'd done all of her videos. So I was like, oh, yeah, just Julia.
Just
okay,
old Julia.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is keen on kind of doing some co-directing and is interested in being part of this, and would you be keen? And, you know, after shitting bricks, I said yes. And then, yeah, so it was an amazing day. And then we ended up doing another one of my clips with them both as well. So both Nick and Julia are an absolute delight to work with. And I very much look up to Julia and, you know, and how I have to say Julia Jacklin. Sorry, I can't just say Julia. And how, like, you know, she conducts herself as an artist. And, and, you know, her whole thing is just incredible. I really admire her. She's wonderful.
She is wonderful. It's quite a nice genealogy going on that stage as well, because Marlon Williams is on there too, and there's all the nice little lines and links that connect all these laneway bands together.
Yeah, it's very special.
This song's called Trix. Please dance with us.
Interested in who is in your sort of scene in Australia. Who do you kind of like look to when you're making music?
That's a great question. I actually just made a pact with myself to stop listening to new music for like a month just to kind of cleanse myself, because every time I sit down at a piano or guitar, I'm like, okay, you're not Kate Le Bon, you're not Aldous Harding, you just need to like be yourself, don't try and be that. Like, I just like, because I'm just such a fan of so many artists that it almost is daunting to sometimes be your own person. So, but you know, my local community over in Fremantle, which is in Western Australia, is very tight and very supportive. And so I can't really mention like an artist in particular, but I definitely go to local gigs and go to shows where I used to play and still play today and stuff like that. So that really helps me ground myself and get back into what I want to sound like or who I want to be, I guess.
Because who would we be without local scenes, you know?
Totally.
It's what keeps the lifeblood pumping.
Totally. And, I played locally for 10 years before getting a gig outside of Perth. So, it's very important to me to maintain those, you know, connections.
To go back to what you were saying earlier about the covers band that you were in, because I know that was a bit of a, like, kickstart on making your own music.
Yeah.
What is it, I guess, that was like the final straw for you, where you were like, I'm sick of this, I'm going to have to write my own stuff now?
Yeah, I think playing Love Shack 250 times will do it for you. You know,
I think that's fair.
I think they could use that as some sort of torture technique. I don't know. It could definitely get some answers. But yeah, I really kind of, it just got depressing, you know, and I was forced to kind of, not forced, but, you know, I'd kind of have to wear heels and dress up and be this kind of person. And a lot of like those rich corporate world people just kind of took liberties and, you know, stuff like that. But I think the final straw was I was playing a pharmaceutical company's Christmas party and some dick got up and, like, slapped me on the ass and tried to grab the mic and sing. And it was just, like, one of those horrible nights where you just feel like a little, like an object kind of thing. So, yeah, I think all of those things piled together were just like, yeah, got to get out of here now. You know, this isn't music anymore. And then I just, like, got a job in a bar and joined a bunch of bands and tried to start writing my own stuff.
Well, you definitely seized the power back with this record because it feels like a massive fuck you to all of that. But also it's so, you know, uplifting. It's such an enjoyable record to listen to. I kind of grinned from start to finish. Even in the kind of like gnarly, sticky songs, what your album does so well is it allows you to kind of find your own way through it, like laugh your way through it or like sing your way through it.
Essentially, it's just a very personal diary that I put out to the whole world.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.